From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, four Michigan congressmen sign on to the Texas lawsuit seeking to overturn Michigan's election results.
They're saying, you know, they just want more time to investigate some of these allegations, even though courts have already heard a lot of these arguments and dismissed them.
Also, a Lenawee County winemaker talks about trying to keep his business alive during the darkest days of the year.
I think we're going to have to look at a complete change in how we do things, and that is if we survive.
Plus, an octogenarian whose childhood and family were torn apart by nationalism reflects on how to live in a society that's not making much sense.
What we need to work for is unity and unification and understanding and overcoming the divide and overcoming the hatred.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today we speak with Holocaust survivor and peace activist Irene Butter about living in a divided society.
The question is, how do you maintain hope, maintain resilience, and how do you maintain your desire to get beyond this, to survive it all?
That's coming up later in the show, but first, four Michigan congressmen have signed on to a brief in support of the Texas lawsuit against Michigan, Georgia, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. The suit is asking the Supreme Court to nullify the popular vote and allow state legislatures to assign delegates to the Electoral College. The suit, based on premises of voter fraud that have been widely debunked, has been deeply divisive in Michigan politics, where Trump voters have been swamping election officials with calls and emails demanding action, despite repeated assurances from election officials of both political parties that no fraud, in fact, occurred. Jonathan Osteen covers politics for Bridge Magazine. Jonathan, welcome back to Stateside.
Hey, April. Thank you for having me.
So who are the four members of the congressional delegation who've signed on?
Well, it is Congressman Jack Bergman of Watersmeet, that's up in the UP, Bill Huizenga of Zeeland, John Molinar of Midland, and Tim Walberg of Tipton. So the only two Republicans who didn't sign on then were Fred Upton of St. Joseph and Paul Mitchell over in Dryden. Paul Mitchell is retiring. He's not running for re-election. And he's been pretty outspoken, you know, opposing the president's efforts to overturn the election.
The ones who did sign on, what are they saying about why they wanted to see the case get before the Supreme Court?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, both the congressional members and then state legislators also, 15 state legislators signed on. They're saying, you know, they just want more time to investigate some of these allegations, even though courts have already heard a lot of these arguments and dismissed them. In particular, the lawsuit, and then it's echoed by the Congress members and legislators, raises issue with Jocelyn Benson, the Michigan Secretary of State, and her decision to mail out absentee ballot applications to try and reach every voter this year. In the run-up to the election, they claim that was a non-legislative action or an action that she should have needed legislative approval for. It's an issue courts here in Michigan have already taken up, and they've sided with Benson. The Michigan Court of Appeals, in fact, has said Benson acted lawfully when she mailed out those applications. You know, Attorney General Dana Nessel notes in her reply brief, people who got those applications and then voted did nothing wrong. You know, they still cast legal ballots, even if there's a dispute over, you know, how those applications were mailed out earlier this year.
Jonathan, I know you're not a legal analyst, but do you have any sense of why Michigan is included in the Texas lawsuit? The vote here was not really that close. Joe Biden won by over 150,000 votes.
Yeah, I mean, it's a simple, you know, math equation. Supporters of the president need to take out as many electoral votes as they can to prevent Joe Biden from winning the 306 electors he's in line for. And they need to do that by Monday, theoretically, when the electoral colleges are actually set to meet in state legislatures across the country. So Michigan, yeah, it wasn't super close. 154,000 votes is about 14 times the margin that Trump won here by here in 2016. But It's a state that Trump is really focused on. And in particular, he and his allies have raised a lot of questions about the absentee ballot voting process at the TCF Center in Detroit. Again, they've largely argued process issues and haven't proven that anyone actually voted unlawfully.
So looking at some of the districts that are involved here, Jack Bergman and John Molinar represent deeply red areas of Michigan. But Bill Huizenga and Tim Walberg's districts are a little bit more mixed. Is there any reason to think that there might be a political price to pay down the road for siding with the president in this way?
Possibly. I mean, the thing to know about congressional districts is, of course, that they're going to change by the time these lawmakers have to run for re-election in 2022. You know, an independent redistricting commission right now is beginning the process of drawing new boundaries. So, you know, a representative like Tim Walberg, he's, you know, managed to have a district that was drawn in a pretty favorable way for him to hold on to that seat. You know, if he loses any of that advantage, you know, in the way the district is drawn, certainly he could already be susceptible to a challenge. And yeah, I mean, I think, you know, voters, we'll see if, you know, 2 years is a long ways away, but certainly I imagine critics are going to point out that he joined this lawsuit and ask voters, you know, why should they support him if he previously sought to invalidate their votes?
Jonathan Osteen covers politics for Bridge Michigan. You can read his work there and follow him on Twitter. Jonathan, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you, April.
We reached out to the four congressmen who agree with the Texas lawsuit. We haven't heard back from Tim Walberg, Jack Bergman, or John Molinar. Bill Huizenga's office says that he may be able to join us next week. We'll have any of them on in the coming days if they'd like to talk. Young hardwood forests are having a hard time growing in northern Michigan. The state is undertaking its largest research project ever to address the problem, spending almost $1 million. The solutions may sound counterintuitive, like more aggressive logging. Peter Payette has been covering this story for Interlock and Public Radio, and he joins us now. Hi, Peter.
Hello, April.
What do we mean when we say that the forests cannot grow?
Well, what that really means is certain tree species can't regenerate. There are tree species like sugar maple and white cedar and eastern hemlock that you can find growing in many places, larger, mature trees. But what you don't find are trees that are 6 or 8 or 12 feet tall in many of those places. These trees are just having a very difficult time growing up a new generation.
So why not? What's the botanical reason for these problems?
Well, there are a couple of problems. And one is there are a lot of deer in Michigan. We have a large deer herd, and deer eat many of these trees that you're not seeing regenerate. Trees that deer don't like to eat, like beech, are everywhere. Some northern hardwood forests are becoming thickets of young beech because the deer avoid those. But there are some other issues as well, and that's the focus of this research that the Department of Natural Resources is doing. The work is being led by a guy named Mike Walters. He's a forestry ecologist at Michigan State University. And what he likes to talk about is what he calls the unintended consequences of gentle logging. And that is to say, the use of forests, the logging in forests, is pretty gentle, and sometimes that has consequences that we don't like. So, for instance, loggers in forests treat the forest floor pretty gently. For instance, they are asked to do a lot of their work in the winter when the ground is frozen. And that sounds pretty good, right?
Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, what's happened as a result of that is that we don't get forest floor disturbance in these areas that is required for some small seeded trees to germinate. And those include the birches and hemlock and species like that.
In fact, April, Mike told me that eastern hemlock is now like 80 or 90% less abundant on the landscape than it was a century ago.
That's substantial. Do we know how widespread these problems are throughout the state?
So we're talking about millions of acres of hardwood forests and white cedar forests. A lot of the forest landscape in northern lower Michigan is affected this way, and in the UP to a lesser extent.
Do we know how long this has been a topic among foresters who've been keeping an eye on it?
Well, I get the sense that everyone in conservation and forestry is well aware of this set of problems, but I don't hear much conversation about it. And that may be because it's unclear what you can really do. It's such a complicated set of human and biological interactions. Some people would say the solution is we just need fewer deer, but it's not clear how you would substantially reduce the deer population. And the deer hunters probably wouldn't really accept that solution anyway. I learned about it about 5 years ago because the Conservancy in Leelanau County was purchasing a large forest tract called Palmer Woods, and they were building what's called a deer exclosure, which means it's a big fence to keep deer out. And the Leelanau Conservancy and other conservancies will construct these to demonstrate and experiment with what forests can look like without a lot of deer overbrowsing on them.
Huh. So are there any other solutions that you've heard about among people who are feeling like it's worth taking a shot at fixing the problem?
So I think this would be the research that Mike Walters is doing for the state of Michigan. And what he is really exploring, and he's working on well more than 100 forest plots across northern Michigan and the UP, and they're exploring more aggressive logging, as you said in their opening. And in some cases, they're going in and taking out nearly all of the trees in an area, leaving a few large, what they call seed trees, or they'll take out maybe half of the trees. They're experimenting to see if they open up the forest more, if the deer will stay away, because deer like to, you know, have some cover and not be left out in the open. They are also doing what they call scarifying the forest floor. They're actually tearing up the forest floor. So some of those trees that don't regenerate well, like eastern hemlock, have more of a chance to regenerate. And what they're hoping is they can get a lot more young trees coming up in these forests as a result of management, and that there will be enough to feed the deer that are there. But as well, many of those will grow into young and then mature trees.
Peter Payette of Interlochen Public Radio. Peter, thanks for telling us about this.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for your interest.
Peter originally reported about this story on Interlochen's weekly show, Points North. You can hear it as a podcast. You know, a lot of small Michigan wineries depend on their tasting rooms and event hosting for revenue. But business has dried up during the pandemic.
It was like dominoes. Everything in March just started falling off until, you know, there was nothing left on the board.
Up next, we hear from a Lenawee County winemaker who's trying to keep his business afloat. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. This has been a very lean season for Michigan's wine industry. Many labels that had enjoyed several years of growth and evolving hopes for Michigan joining the ranks of other states challenging dominant regions on the American market saw everything come to a screeching halt in 2020. A big part of the state's wine culture are the many tasting rooms where Michigan residents and Michigan visitors can experience the product and learn more about the brands. Tasting rooms have had a very hard time under COVID restrictions. Mike Wells is the founder and owner of Blackfire Winery. Located in Lenawee County, he's been hosting events and producing product for several years now, but this year has posed challenges to his business among many others, and we wanted to talk to him about the situation. Mike Wells, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Your winery offers a full menu of varietals, Pinot Gris, Malbec, Chardonnay, all kinds of things, as well as a full line of beers and ciders. And I know that you've hosted tastings and events and pairing dinners of many kinds. What would normally be going on at Blackfire at this time of year?
Well, I think we would probably be looking at a Christmas party. We would be hosting private events for businesses that are having their Christmas parties this time of the year as well. Needless to say, none of that has happened this year and won't happen this year.
Can you tell us about the level of production that you were keeping up, say, at this time last year before the virus kind of sent everything into the blender?
Well, this is our fifth year of being in business, and Things have been growing and growing. And this year we had a lot of things originally planned that have all stopped. We do a lot of hosting of buses, and we also have our own events that we put on, and we were planning quite a few for this year, as well as we host weddings. And needless to say, it was like dominoes. Everything in March just started falling off until, you know, there was nothing left on the board. My business model in doing this was always to be able to sell directly out of the tasting room. We weren't ever anticipating on having to change that to where we might have to start looking at selling in stores. We've had a few restaurants that we deal with, and, you know, needless to say, they've been hurt, as well as a couple other retail outlets that we sell our wines.
Can you say a bit about why the in-person experience was important to you when you started the winery?
Well, one of the things that we've always been really proud of is the fact that, you know, people come in as strangers, and if not that trip or the next trip, they've left as friends. We've got the vineyard, we've got a big deck, and we're very personable with the customer. So we try to make it an experience. Coming in to buy the bottle of wine and getting out is just not what we were ever trying to do. Same thing with the beer. We want you to come in and stay.
Right. Tell me about your thoughts and what's been on your mind as you consider what you're going to need to do to keep the business alive.
Well, I know that in the short run, and when I say that, I'm thinking at least the next year or two, that we have to change the way we're doing things and plan on getting our products into the stores. And I think that the tasting room end of it, it's not looking promising. Currently, we have igloos, which we've had. This is our second season with igloos, and we are able to rent those out, but that's not going to carry it for us. There's a lot of expense in having a winery as well as a brewery and doing ciders as well. It takes a lot to keep that going. So I think we're going to have to look at a complete change in how we do things. And that is if we survive. And that's in question right now.
What would it entail to get retailers to carry your product? Does that involve just doing the shoe leather of figuring out which retailers might be a good placement for the brands and just doing the work of going out and contacting people and seeing if they're interested in partnering?
Well, that's part of it. It depends on what level you're looking at. If it's a smaller place, then it is just, you know, someone coming in the door with maybe samples and with the hope that you can get an in there, or other and larger stores, there's a process. And we are looking at that. Unfortunately for me, I'm not a salesperson. I guess I could be, but, you know, I'm also the winemaker and the brewer. And so my time is really limited as to what else I can put on that plate.
What's it like trying to get into online sales at a time like this?
That might be the easiest thing for us. We are in the process. I have someone that is changing our website. You know, for our first 2 years, we didn't even have a website. We went off Facebook. We had a really large response from that. Now I see the importance of the website. So we're trying to do that, get our products on it. As I said earlier, we weren't planning on selling out of the tasting room. So now we're looking at getting our beers canned, our ciders canned, and being able to sell it online as well as in retail outlets. So more expense and not the money for it.
I want to take this opportunity to correct an error that I made last month. We were talking to another couple of brewers out of Grand Rapids, and at that time we stated that those guys were the first fully Black-owned brand in Michigan. I stand corrected. Your brewery has been going for, as you say, some time now, although not as long as the winery. Will you tell us a little bit about your entree into both winemaking and brewing? I mean, you had a full career as a firefighter before you started doing this. Will you tell the story of how you got interested in doing something different?
Well, I've been interested in winemaking since I was 16. I think it was kind of fate that I had woke up one day and decided that I was going to make some wine. I grew up in the city of Detroit, and my parents were fortunate enough to where they own the lot next door. And my dad was a big gardener, and he had farmer all through him. And so we had a lot of fruits and vegetable things growing on that lot, as well as some grapevines that were in our backyard. And I woke up one day and decided at 16, I was going to make some wine. And it was in the fall and the grapes were ready. And I went out and picked them all and made my first batch of wine. Now, that might not sound that strange, but this was a long time ago. There was no internet. And the funnier part is my parents didn't drink alcohol. And so I wound up putting it in pop bottles and put it in the back of my dad's closet. And he kept his suits in the back along with our suitcases and that. And I'd go back there every couple of days with a flashlight. And I knew nothing back then about fermentation. I thought it was percolating. So I thought when I was looking at it that it was definitely working because it was percolating. But typical kid, I forgot about it. And sometime in the future, I have a brother that's 11 years older. He was by and he asked me about it. And I told him I didn't know if it was done or not. And so I decided to go get some, and we were sitting at the kitchen table sampling it. And my dad came in, and I think I'd had about three bottles of it by then. And he had asked, what I was doing. And I told him we were trying my wine, and he was intrigued at first until he found out that they were all in the closet by his suits, at which time he told me to get them out of there. And I stood up. And that's when I got the effect of having those bottles of wine. And I've kind of been hooked on the whole process of making it ever since.
Mike, I'm afraid to ask, but what did that first batch taste like?
You know, it's been so long that I can't remember. But I have to assume that it was palatable, because otherwise I probably wouldn't have continued.
When you got to the point where you were ready to make a go of the business, and obviously you had more experience under your belt, what did you want to offer at Blackfire that was different?
Well, it was a few things. We had some property living out in Tecumseh, and I was able to buy the property next door, which added more property. And the idea originally was I was going to have my dad move out here, but that didn't work. And I decided one day that when I retired that I wanted to take this from the hobby to the commercial level. And I started looking around, and I found that Michigan State University at the time had a program. And I did that for 2 years, where I went and learned how to commercially make wine as well as commercially grow grapes, which I didn't know how to do. I got done with that, and we just planted our first 5 acres of grapes. And haven't really looked back since then, and we've got 11 acres of grapes now. We added the tasting room. We got the doors open to the winery in 2016, thanks to a very good friend up in Grand Rapids that has a winery and was really my mentor, Cascade Winery. He told me I needed to get my brewing license as well. And at that point, I was saying, why? Because I'm never making beer. And he said, you'll understand this after you open up. Get your brewer's license. So I did. And about 6 months later, I figured out, yeah, we need to start making beer.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Mike Wells. He's the owner of Blackfire Winery in Lenawee County. Mike, we're getting a lot of information about the availability and distribution of the vaccines that are being developed to fight COVID. And I think a lot of people are sort of trying to just buckle down and tough it out right now with the assumption that things might be different in 2021 once vaccine doses become available to the public. Are you going forward with the assumption that once the vaccine is widely available to consumers, that things will go back to normal?
Personally, I don't think that's going to happen in 2021. I think that it'll be maybe mid-2022 before I think things will be somewhat back to what we'd call normal. I'm thinking that there's enough fear in people that they're not going to want to be the first ones to try this vaccine. And even then, I think it's going to take time for this to come back around.
Yeah. I imagine the nature of event-related business, too, is just people have to feel confident enough to plan something and to put money down to, you know, to reserve a room and reserve their time and just to get back in the habit of gathering in great numbers.
That is quite true. This year, all of our events were canceled, with the exception of one. Once a year, we do a wild game dinner, and it's not a moneymaker for me. It's something that I like to do. Needless to say, it's a certain segment of people that like wild game. And we went ahead and did that event this year. And it really showed how things have changed. Just about everyone that was coming wanted to know how we were going to make sure that they'd be safe for this event. And what we've done in the past, it was always a buffet style. You could come in, you could try whatever you wanted. And this year, we had to get a tent that was four times as large. Normally it's held inside or on our deck, but this year we did it under a tent outside. We had to have the table spaced far enough apart so that everyone was socially distanced. We only had a maximum of six people at a table. The space that was required to keep everyone apart is why we had to have this massive tent to get everyone in, which we could have had hundreds of people in this tent otherwise. But they still came and everyone had a great time. So I see where it can be done. It just takes a lot of precaution and it costs more because of having those precautions.
Yeah. It sounds like you've been extremely busy trying to keep the business going. I don't know if there's been a lot of time for reflection, but what do you miss the most about having people out to the winery?
Oh, the conversations. I mean, people have compared this to Cheers. If you remember that television show, it's a place where a lot of the favorites come in all the time. They come in for the conversation. Unlike a lot of other places where you may just come in with your friends, you stay with your friends, you leave with your friends. This is the kind of place where you meet people, and a lot of friendships are made here by the fact that people converse. And we like that. And that's what we've always done with our events, too. And that's one of the things I really miss, because we try to do monthly or every other month events. Sometimes you might come in and you'd expect that you'd be with the person that you're with. And we might do that this time, but the next time we might make it an endless table and make you sit with everybody else. By doing that, we always had great conversations going on with people.
It looks like Congress is getting closer to a second round of COVID relief. And some people are even predicting that a bill might get passed before the end of the year. Would that be soon enough to help you and other small wineries survive?
I think one of the biggest problems with this is, you know, I put everything that I own into this winery, and I've had no control over keeping it going. And as much as they put out that there's these grants available, that there's, you know, all these loans available, it's so freaking difficult to do anything. The grants that I've applied for, within 8 minutes, it's full. And you're too late. When I was applying for the federal loan, the computer system stopped working. I never completed it. When I did try to come back and complete it, I couldn't get on. Eventually, I was able to go back and finish it. And it was just pushing a button saying it was complete. And I was saying, how's it complete? I haven't even put the financial stuff in it. And then I came back and they were offering me a loan. I had to call them and I talked to them and I says, how is this possible that you have the information? They says, well, it's in here. I says, well, who put it in? I didn't. The program froze on me. I wasn't able to do this. And they said, well, here's what we can offer you. And that was $5,600. And if you want it changed, you can accept this. And then you can send other documentation in and it can be reviewed and maybe we can make a change. The problem with all those kind of things is there's thousands of people trying to do the same thing. And it's just too slow. But in the meantime, you know, if the doors were open, if we were able to keep working, I'm not a handout kind of guy. I'd like to do things myself. And that's why I'm in business. I also understand why we're shut down. But they can't expect you to keep paying bills when you're not able to make money. And I just think that's the biggest problem.
Michael Wells is the proprietor of Blackfire Winery in Tecumseh. Mike, we wish you luck keeping things going this winter and that everyone can get together at your place sooner rather than later.
Thank you very much. I hope so as well.
Irene Butter has dedicated much of her life to telling her story of survival.
We were deprived of everything, even just the basic necessities of human existence, has given me a lot of insight in terms of what human beings can do to other human beings.
A Michigan city is honoring one of its Holocaust survivors. We'll meet her after a break. Stay with us.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The remarkable life of Professor Irene Hassenberg Butter is known to many people in Michigan. In her 2019 autobiography, Shores Beyond Shores, she formally told the story of her family's escape from Nazi Germany, only to be sent from their haven in Amsterdam to the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp. They were subsequently scattered for a time among refugee settlements before she was finally reunited with her mother and brother some years after World War II ended. Her career at the University of Michigan School of Public Health delivered many dividends beyond her family's story, and she has never missed an opportunity to help people understand what history is trying to tell us. In honor of her work, the city of Ann Arbor is officially declaring December 11th as Irene Butter Day, and she joins us now. Professor Butter, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
As I mentioned, your family lived in Berlin, where you were born, and fled from there to Amsterdam. And ultimately, the Nazis sent your family to the camps. You've had so much time to reflect on the war's effect on your childhood, your father's death, and the unraveling of your family's lives. Is there anything that you wish that the little girl who was put on a train could know?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer. I would appreciate if I had understood better what was going on with the persecution of the Jews.
What did your mother and father tell you before you had to get on the move?
Well, they really protected us a great deal. They didn't give us a lot of information. I think their main concern was that we would be frightened and produce anxiety. So they didn't tell us a whole lot.
It's kind of stunning to think that parents' concern for children is so great that they might be reinterpreting the things that were happening all around them and still trying to preserve, you know, what innocence and sense of safety they could provide at that point.
Yeah, that's true. Because, you know, whatever was happening, we could see, we could observe. So we just learned it from experience rather than from history or from explanation of the context.
What have you come to understand about the shaping effect that these experiences had on your life?
Well, I think going through an experience, 2 years of barbaric experience where we were deprived of everything, even just the basic necessities of human existence, has given me a lot of insight in terms of what human beings can do to other human beings that should never happen. and wishing that the Holocaust would have taught lessons to humanity to be more compassionate, to be more tolerant, and to be more humane.
Yeah.
That's what I think, where I think education has failed.
You didn't start sharing your family story until later in life, when at your daughter's request, you first started visiting classrooms and talking to students. Can you tell me a little bit about what it was like the very first time you told that story?
Well, very frightening, because my daughter was inviting me to her class in middle school when she was taking a course in public speaking in Ann Arbor. And at the end of the course, she had to give a one-hour speech. And the topic that she chose was anti-Semitism, Hitler's conquest of Europe and the concentration camps. And she came home and she said, "Mom, will you be my visual aid and tell the students about the concentration camps?" And I was floored when she came home and requested me to do this, but how could I turn her down? And luckily, everything went well.
You've dedicated so much of your time to telling the story and working through what might be an appropriate response to hate. In your professional life, you co-founded the Raoul Wallenberg Lecture Series at the University of Michigan and a prize that honors heroes of human rights. And you also helped to start an Arab-Jewish women's dialogue group based in Ann Arbor. What would you like for people to know about how political rhetoric at a national or state leadership level, how that influences what we all experience in the behavior of everyday people?
Well, unfortunately, we live in a time of polarization and division and the promotion of hatred and divide. And so the fact that that influences people and increases prejudice and discrimination and intolerance and hatred is very sad. And so I feel that the more we talk about love, about compassion, about the fact that all human beings are made of the same fabric, irregardless of color, of ethnicity, nationality, religion, those things should not and actually do not divide us as long as we're open to differences and realize that those differences can enrich us rather than divide us.
There are moments in history that change the world in profound ways, and obviously World War II was one of them. I don't mean to compare what's happening with the COVID pandemic in this country right now to the Holocaust. But at the same time, this is probably one of the most significant historic events that a lot of people alive right now have lived through. And I'm just wondering what you observe going on in both your own community and nationally right now, as certain things that we assumed to be true about American society get turned upside down.
Well, that is true. People are isolated from each other. Families are divided. The usual kinds of reunions and celebrations cannot happen. And there is so much rhetoric that people are filled with anxiety and fear. And that's certainly analogous to a time of war. And I think another analogy would be the fact that we don't really know when this will be over. We know a little bit better that there is some hope in sight now for these vaccines, but for a long time, we didn't know how long this would last and how long the disease would be spreading. And as more and more people contract COVID, we're more and more in danger of contracting it ourselves. So the question is, how do you maintain hope and how do you maintain resilience and how do you re- maintain your desire to get beyond this, to survive it all. And that's the difficulty. You know, can we celebrate Christmas next year the way we will not be able to celebrate it now? Will I be able to go to my grandchild's graduation next year, even though there are no graduations right now? And all of this is very difficult. And to live with uncertainty is a difficulty in and of itself.
I think part of what I see people struggling with right now is certain realizations about the fact that folks in their own family might feel very differently about something as relatively simple as matters of public health than they do, or maybe that the political divisions that they might have felt in years past, you know, they could just sort of talk around, that maybe those are harder to avoid, or maybe questioning whether they should try to avoid those political differences and those conversations right now. Do you have any advice for people who are looking around right now and feeling like they may not recognize their communities or people in their families?
Well, you raise a very critical point, I think, because often the people I've met anyway, if someone in their family has the opposite point of view, or a neighbor or whoever it might be, they say, well, I will never speak to her again, him or her again, because I can't tolerate that point of view. And I don't think that helps us, because what we need to work for is unity and unification and understanding and overcoming the divide and overcoming the hatred. So I would like to say that it's a better strategy to try to talk and to go deeper and find out why people feel one way or another, and whether there might not be commonalities that are avoided by not speaking. And certainly it doesn't help us to come closer together than we are today. Now, I know this is very difficult. I have not always succeeded in talking to people of the on the opposite end of the perspective, but I think we shouldn't give up.
As I mentioned, you founded a discussion group that is based on the ideal that we should talk to each other, even when we don't agree. Can you tell us anything that has been helpful as the women involved in Zaytuna, some of them Arab, some of them Jewish, have gotten to know each other? What were some things that were helpful in trying to talk through differences?
Well, the crux of Zaytuna, of our meetings, is to talk about difficult issues and to express our individual opinions, even if they vary, if they differ. And in order to remain sisters, friends, we don't have to agree about everything, but we might find new meaning in our discussions. And of course, we come closer together when we understand our histories, our backgrounds, our narratives, and why we are oriented in one way or another.
May I ask how this professor emerita of public health and survivor is spending Hanukkah in the midst of the pandemic?
Well, unfortunately, not with family as I had wished, but I'm very fortunate that my son, who lives in San Francisco, has come here to celebrate, and we couldn't be together for the first 4 days until he was tested, and luckily the test came out negative. So the rest of his visit and all of Hanukkah, we can be together, and we will Skype and Zoom with other members of the family and other friends.
Professor Butter, it is such a joy to hear your voice. Thank you for making some time to talk to us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
It may feel like winter, but technically it's still fall. Here's Michigan Radio's Lester Graham and mixologist Tammy Coxon with a cocktail to kick off your weekend.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
And that's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. Looks like another fall day for us.
It is a fall day, so I made you a fall drink.
Okay, well, that's nice. What's in it?
So this is kind of a riff on an old-fashioned, one of yours and mine favorite drinks. It's bourbon-based, and then as our sweetener for our old-fashioned, we have two different ingredients. So we have maple syrup, good old Michigan maple syrup, and then we have some Nocino. So Nocino is an Italian-in-origin walnut liqueur. A little bit like an Amaro, but not as bitter as an Amaro. So this is made from unripe green walnuts, and then it gets steeped in alcohol and sweetened, and there's various other kinds of botanicals that are in it.
Yeah, this is not Italian, though.
I know the label. No, this is not Italian. So that's the category, is Nocino. This is, of course, from Michigan. This is from Long Road Distillers, as was the bourbon that I'm using. And they use those green walnuts, and then they've also got some cinnamon, nutmeg, and allspice in here. Some nice fall notes. Those are kind of in the background. This really is kind of a very nutty liqueur. That's really what it's adding. It's really nice for this time of year. Adds some weight and heaviness. It'll keep you warm like a sweater.
Well, I'm a fan of walnuts. I'm just not sure about green walnuts. That's a new one on me.
Well, that's going to give it that little bit of a bitter edge. And you and I both know that bitters in cocktails are delicious.
Exactly.
And so this is like, it's nutty, but it's not sweet nutty like an amaretto. And it's bitter, but it's not heavy duty bitter like an Amaro. It's just a nice middle of the road.
I see you're not shaking, you're putting it all into the glass.
I was feeling very lazy today. So the nice thing about an old fashioned, right, is that you can just build it in the glass that you're going to serve it in. Added a dash of bitters. I used the Chocolate Mole bitters from a company called Bitterman's. Not Michigan. I need more Michigan bitters, people. But any chocolate bitters would do here. If you don't have a chocolate bitters, you could use Angostura bitters would also be great.
Not a lot of cocoa trees in Michigan.
No, that's true. That's true. But we have some great chocolate companies like Mindo Chocolate.
That's true.
Yeah. So just stirred that all up till it was good and cold. And then I'm just going to drink it right out of that glass. So I added a little bit more ice to fill it up to the top. And I'm going to garnish it with an orange twist for a nice aroma and a hit of citrus flavor.
Well, it looks kind of like an old fashioned. It's a little darker than an old fashioned.
That Nocino is really dark. It's almost inky in its darkness.
But otherwise, if I didn't know, I'm going to take a taste.
I'm curious what you think.
It's not as bitter as I thought it might be.
No.
It is nutty. I like that walnut taste, but it's not. How do I describe it? I wouldn't be able to identify that as walnut.
No, exactly. And that's, I think, part of the fact that it's those green walnuts, right? So they do have this different flavor than what you're used to eating. But it's nutty. It's definitely nutty. You just wouldn't know which nut.
It's quite sweet, too, I think.
That's the maple syrup going on there as well. And you could definitely dial that back a little. It's only got 1/4 ounce of Nocino to 1/4 ounce of maple syrup to 2 ounces of bourbon. So there's not a lot of those sweet ingredients in there, but you could always adjust those proportions to suit your tastes or add a little extra bourbon if you want to dry it out that way.
Well, the nice thing about this is, and I've had 2 sips and I'm going to stop there. The first time it was kind of a shock to my senses and I wasn't sure what to make of it. The second time I got a better feel, a little more expectation about what to, and I could search for other things on my palate. And the second sip was even better than the first sip.
Absolutely. And that, of course, is part of the charm of an old fashioned, those drinks that are built and served on ice, is that often the first sip is going to be, whoa, okay, this is strong. And then as it waters down from the ice melting, the drink transforms into something else. And I find that's especially noticeable in drinks that have maple syrup in them because we perceive maple syrup as being quite sweet just because of the mix of sugars that are in it. And so having that little extra time to sit on ice can definitely transform that.
And what do you call this drink?
Just the fallback.
The fallback.
Fallback.
It's nice. Well, cheers.
Cheers.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Bear. Thanks so much for listening. See you next week.